started and grown several multi-million dollar businesses. His mission is to help you do the same. Welcome to the Business Growth Pod, building the future one entrepreneur at a time.
The dollar is weak. The central bank looks upside down. I need a really good store of value. So now you have people like Goldman Sachs that have gone 180 degrees and they're saying Bitcoin can absolutely coexist with gold as a digital gold and not be an existential threat. They can peacefully coexist.
Hey everyone, welcome to the show. I'm Alan. I'm a family man, an attorney, and an entrepreneur. Each week, we provide resources and advice to help build your business. Are you ready? Then let's go. Hey everyone, welcome to the show today. I'm excited to welcome Joe Hagan to today's show. Joe's the founder and president of Wealth Colony, and he's the managing director of Script Mob. Welcome to the show, Joseph.
Hi, Alan. Thank you for having me.
So, Joe, will you tell me a little bit about Wealth Colony, a little bit about your background, just so our listeners can get to know you just a bit?
Sure. And thank you for that. I launched in 1989 and went straight to Wall Street, working for Shearson and Lehman Brothers when they were owned by Smith Barney, right before they merged with Smith Barney when they were owned by American Express, right across the street from the New York Stock Exchange. Very exciting. I spent 20 years staring at a screen and managing, you know, 400 or 500 accounts on a high level. And in the last 10 years, really, it's been about Wealth Colony and, you know, private equity, bringing friends, family, partners, former clients, people in the Wealth Colony ecosystem, just access to the type of alternative private investments they'd never get access to or even hear about, you know, if it wasn't for, you know, my homework, my research, my proximity to some fintech pioneers that I met, you know, in my first 20 years on Wall Street. So that's what I do.
Gotcha. Okay. So you were on Wall Street for about 20 years. And what were the types of things that you were investing in? Did you have particular industries or sectors that were, you know, your strengths, or did you kind of, you know, get experience with a lot of different things?
So I was agnostic and I crushed it. And here's the reason why. So I give a lot of my credit, right, in my journey and my success, which was a really good trajectory, from my family values, right? First of all, I shared a bedroom with three older brothers. So I learned at a young age how to fight to get to my sock drawer on a daily basis just to, you know, be able to get some cereal and some breakfast and, you know, get off to school. Wouldn't have it any other way. But that really taught me a lot about strength and competition and, you know, just being mentally strong. And literally, I watched my mom and dad work really hard, you know, get blood out of every nickel, if you will, and send the four of us to, you know, private grammar school, high school, and college. You know, we went out to dinner. We had a nice summer vacation, but really it was, you know, hand to mouth, you know, just above the middle class line, barely. Right. So what happened, Alan, is I took, first of all, playing sports allowed me to go away to college. Right. Otherwise, I was going to have to work. I'm originally from the Bronx, New York. My mom still lives there. I was either going to Fordham University or Manhattan College. But since I was taught by Marist Brothers at Mount St. Michael Academy, they said, hey, we're building up the football program. We saw your film. We'd love you to go away. Now, it was only an hour north, but that gave me a social education that I would have never received had I stayed home. And it was probably the best 4 years of my life. And it prepared me for Wall Street. And so when I got onto Wall Street, if you can imagine, a year to 2 years after I graduated, Bill Clinton was running for president, going down the, you know, down Wall Street, shaking hands, you know, getting votes. And I was learning about the stock market. The funny thing, Alan, is back then, you literally had to learn how to tell people and explain to people that the stock market is a viable investment, that it's worth investing your money in. And the reason is the average investor, you know, out there in America that I called on, you know, had a decade of CDs paying, you know, 10, 12%, right, with no risk. So why take risk, right? So those rates were going down. It was a great time to invest in the, you know, early 90s. The difference is that I also had some street smarts along with some book smarts. And I always told clients, look, I'm street smart, I'm book smart, and I'm smart enough to know that I'm not that smart. Like, there are geniuses before me, after me, and during my time here on Wall Street. I'm going to do my best to constantly bring you value and something that makes sense. I'm not going to try and wow you with all these charts and talk about trading on, you know, breakouts and candles and all these other, you know, different types of strategies that you heard and all these analysts that sounded really smart in their research report. But at the end of the day, like if you keep scoring a game, right, well, are they right or are they wrong? Like what's their score? And so for me, Alan, what really became present for me was I realized that 80% in business, right, of your revenue comes from the top 20% of your clients. And I'm looking at what we're doing as retail brokers at Shearson Lehman Brothers. And I'm realizing that the bread is buttered here at Shearson from their institutional accounts by far. And it was probably more like 90-10 on Wall Street and still is. So for me, I'm watching the process and I'm asking questions to myself as it's happening. And they would have, you know, the morning meeting on the Squawk Box and they'd hand out a fresh new glossy research report. We're buying ABC company today because of bop, 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 bop. And, and it's that's great. There's been some good news in the company. But, you know, I'm a bottom line guy and I would look at it. And even though I was anxious to learn and wet behind the ears just arriving and getting licensed on Wall Street, I'm like, okay, just to give you an example, the stock's 40. The analyst loves it now at 40. It was like 25 last year. Like, aren't you supposed to buy low and sell high? And I would just keep questioning these things. So those questions, and I would watch all of the retail army run to their clients and say, hey, we got a fresh buy report on ABC company and you got to buy it and blah, blah, blah. So I guess the distribution for the institutions that wanted to take profits, and this was my humble, you know, guess, right? I was inquiring in my own mind, is this the process? Is this what's happening? You're getting all kinds of distribution because you've got an army of retail brokers calling their clients and all the mom and pops are buying a 500, 1,000, 5,000 shares. And, you know, it allows the stock to, you know, not, you know, absorb profit taking, if you ask me. And that's just kind of what I felt. Now that's not a blueprint that happens every single time, but I just felt it happened more times than not. I got to befriend an old timer that was a bond broker, and I used to work late hours, you know, and I asked him one time, I said, he was a bond broker and I was, you know, predominantly trading and buying stocks. I'm like, what's that? And that, Alan, was a Bloomberg machine. And I'm like, so I'm glad I asked questions, and he started showing it to me. And I said, that's really interesting. I'm like, can you track real-time insider buying from that? Because I always wanted to know what my grandmother taught me at a young age. Watch what they're doing with their hands, not their mouth. And I just felt the analysts were doing it with their mouth and not their hands. So I wanted to know what institutions were buying the stock real-time, what the insiders were doing. I think they're way more relevant than some analysts, that which is my opinion. And I proved that opinion out when he let me go in there every night. And I literally built what I would call my smart insider file. Very generic, very simple. These are guys, Alan, if you played baseball in the pros and you had a card, you flip that card over, that's your batting average. So I wanted to know what insiders and what's their return. So I based it on 6 months. And so once an insider buys a stock, he has to hold it for 6 months. Right? He has to file with the SEC. There's certain blackouts like right before an earnings report or other events. But otherwise, if Wall Street is going to throw the proverbial baby out with the bathwater on your company, you can buy it. You just have to file, you have to disclose it, and you have some restrictions. So I would look out 6 months. Okay, Alan Draper just bought Draper Enterprises. Okay, let me look at his track record. Holy cow, this guy's never been wrong. Now, that doesn't guarantee you're going to be right now. But I'd rather watch you put $1 million or $100,000 or whatever your number is into your own company with your own after-tax money and put your money where your mouth is on your company. I think you know more about your company than some analyst who maybe just graduated Harvard and working at Merrill Lynch. Like that was my theory. And I just stayed really agnostic with that. And I saw that it worked and it worked consistently. It was all about buying it right. And so literally, as long as I bought it right, my discipline, I wasn't going to chase it. I was going to buy it right around where the insider bought it, or I let that opportunity pass. And I would tell you, Alan, I started seeing regularly that by time they would report it in Barron's 3 or 4 weeks later, it was like the old ticker tape. You had an advantage knowing in San Francisco what's going on in New York, you know, ahead of the tape, right? So it was like, I know they're going to publish this in Barron's in a few weeks. So I would just fax constantly. So the Bloomberg was like the internet before the internet with real-time information. And I exploited it. perfectly in perfect integrity and legally. And, you know, Alan, we bought, you know, X amount of shares here at 10. I told you. And now by the time they put it in Barron's, it might be 12, 13, 14. I mean, literally 20, 30, 40% higher very often on the news that the insiders were buying it. Anyway, that being said, you weren't going to be able to do that at a wirehouse, right? You have to follow their rules of engagement, which is fine. So I found a nice small firm that, you know, I promised that I don't want to do any of your investment banking deals because you don't have a track record, right? I don't want to, you know, any of this Wolf of Wall Street type companies that I really don't know. I want to be able to buy my own companies. And if you allow me to do it, I will train 100 brokers for you. Okay. I will literally recruit brokers for you just because you're going to see some success here. I just want to be able to buy and sell typically NASDAQ, NMS stocks, and New York Stock Exchange companies that were liquid with insider buying. And it took off from there. So I think that might have been a long answer, but I can elaborate a little more if that makes sense for you.
No, that's perfect. Yeah. So when you talk about liquidity, are you talking about with these specific companies, are you looking at bottom line revenue? Are you looking at cash flows? Are you looking at top line numbers? What specifically are you looking at?
So volume, number one, like there's a couple of things. Like if an insider had a ridiculously good track record, and I got to tell you, Alan, about 15% of them had never been wrong. What does that mean? It means they made a little bit of money, really didn't lose money whenever they bought their own company stock. If I look at six, if I take a 6 month, you know, window, some of these guys were always right. So again, that didn't guarantee, and all of these disclosures were clear, but some of the things that might disqualify it is, maybe it's a sin stock and they're in cigarettes or something like that. I might discount. Maybe I don't want to get in the weeds with sin stocks. Not all my clients might not appreciate that. I just tried to stay agnostic in something that kind of never would be a square peg in a round hole. Let me make sure that there's no pending litigation. Let me make sure the balance sheet is not upside down. And, you know, the insider is just, you know, has illusions of grandeur on a turnaround and he's buying it. Meanwhile, they file bankruptcy. Like if, as long as we did some basic due diligence and I liked the industry, like I remember Ball Corp home run like two or three times in my 20-year career. You know what they do? They make like cans and jars, like boring stuff. But, you know, their profits would rise dramatically because of this or that eventually. And I only bought it because I followed the insider into it and something like that, you know, often. And I also wanted New York Stock Exchange because I wanted liquidity. There was those firms that existed. I know Wolf of Wall Street was really about Long Island. And it really was about a sales process that was learned at Lehman Brothers with real companies. The only difference is they would take these, you know, quote unquote house stocks in the investment banking world. And there was really no market for it. There was a couple of market makers and they manipulated the living, you know, what out of it. And so there was no way I would ever be involved with something like that. I wanted something where, Alan, I don't care if you gave me an opportunity and a vote of confidence with $10,000, $100,000, $1 million. If you have some emotional reason why you want to sell the stock, I may talk you out of it, whether it's up or down. I may try and attempt to have you really think about it. But it's your money. And if you need it, I'll wire it to you on settlement day. And so I needed to own positions in companies that I can get in and out of with no problem, as opposed to like a Roach Motel, like one of these deals that don't really have volume. And this way, I was building my book of business on granite, like right where I was on Wall Street. Manhattan is built on granite. That's why you got the big buildings. That's how I wanted my book, granite. You know, guy needs his money now. He may come back to me in a year, a month, whenever. But, you know, certainly the relationship equity remains high. And if you maintain your credibility and trust, you know, you can, you know, have a great career. And that's what I always strive to do. I was never going to get caught up in any of these type of, you know, house stocks, you know, with hypes and tips and rumors or anything like that. I literally can talk to you and a guy might be like, all right, like, but I want to ask my wife. And it was very common back then to start saying, you know, some of these lines about, does she ask you what kind of curtains you want? So I said, okay, fine, let's get her on the phone. Because this way, this approach of investing, because no one knows no one knows Draper Enterprises better than Alan Draper. And look at his track record.
Right.
And he wrote a check. So I'm not saying you got to write $1 million, but I think the risk reward ratio at this price, as long as we get in at or right near where he paid, that's the strategy. So risk $10,000. But here's why I think, and I would study the company and some of the things that they put in press releases, why I think it's going to happen. And sure enough, maybe they beat numbers. Maybe they're only down because of weather-related issues, or for some reason there was a delay in a receivable and they missed their numbers and they're going to make up for it next quarter. But in the meantime, the stock just was on a huge discounted trade. So you got those opportunities. And I will tell you that this worked for a very long time. Literally, it was, you know, the mistakes I made, Alan, was when I confused the bull market for genius. When I, and I'll give you one example. I remember having Zircon, XIRC, like $11 a share, built a nice quick position in it with the insiders. Next thing, it's up a few points. I still think it's going higher, so I don't want to sell it. A few weeks later, it has another move, and it's like 18, 19, ready to break 20. So I'm looking at it, and I'm saying, okay, this has only been a few weeks, and I got like 8 or 9 points. You know what? So many times, if you take the profit, like Jay Paul Getty was asked, he's the world's first billionaire. How'd you do it? Simple. I sold too soon. Like, next question. Like, he was never like needing the high. It was like, you got markets giving you, take it. 2 out of 3 times when I took a profit, the stock would pull back. One time it would run. And I never forget, I sold it probably around 18, 19. You know, I made good commissions that were clearly earned. I would have clients often say, no, I don't think you charged me enough. I'm like, believe me, there's a policy, there's a rule. I'm making plenty of money with it. Let's just have that same, you know, relationship tenor if we're down in the next stock. That's all I ask, right? And so we made good money with it. And I would say like a month later, this thing ran to like 45 and Intel bought them out. And I was like, damn, what would have happened if? And I was weak in that emotional. I didn't stay agnostic and objective. And that didn't serve me and my clients, because I did have a big position once, which was up big, and I didn't sell it thinking it was going to go back to 40 and maybe get bought out. And it never did. And I never realized the profit, and it went down. And so I learned my lesson. And literally, like when we started this conversation, Alan, when I was agnostic and I had a discipline and a strategy, I never thought I was that smart. I just knew I had a good filtering system. I explained it well. It had a universal appeal, because you don't know me. And I would often say, if you can get past my New York accent, I guarantee it'll make sense to you. If you don't want to do business, that's fine. Maybe you watch this one and we'll get together on the next one. But my approach passes the mom smell test and literally like your calculus professor's test when it comes to math, because you really only need fifth grade math and a simple understanding of our strategy and how it works. And guys would give me a shot because you're just making sense to them. You're not promising certain things. There's no like ridiculous expectations. You know, once you under promise and outperform, you typically have a client for life. And, you know, that's kind of how I excelled. And what happened was the internet. I was just telling someone today, like, I know about Reddit and I know about short selling, and I don't want to get off on a tangent on that. But I said, look, I'm constantly telling clients, like, I was lucky for someone that's very good and very close with me buying crypto really early. And more so on what we spoke about before, Alan, is that I got a really high level explanation by some really brilliant people that were literally the pioneers of the space. And I got a really early education on that. Now, can I recite that to you the way it was recited to me? No, I got a really good digestion of what it is. And I realized that there was a big change coming, and this is not just going to be a thing. This is going to be an asset class. And they explained early, Bitcoin is only first. It's all about the blockchain, et cetera, et cetera. All these assets around the world are going to be digitized. No fraud, no middleman, the whole nine yards. So I got it. But, you know, at the end of the day, I know a lot of people that I speak to, like, you know, my kid was telling me, I'm like, listen, I've been telling people all the time, listen to your kids. I was 28 years old and I was trading for 7 or 8 years and I was making a lot of money. I was doing really well for my clients and I'm watching these stocks I don't understand. I call this kid that I hired and he was doing well and he was really smart and he was picking some good stocks that I didn't understand because I was a value guy. I'm like, can I ask you a question? They're like, yeah. I'm like, what's a browser? What the hell's the internet? Like, I was 28 and I didn't know.
I mean, that's an interesting point, Joe, right? Because you hear it frequently said, hey, don't invest in what you don't know.
But just because I don't know, because I'm too busy working, doesn't mean I won't try and learn it real quick and be a quick study, if that makes sense.
Gotcha. I want to get to the GameStop thing, actually. But let's talk about cryptocurrency. Let's talk about that. I was first introduced to Bitcoin in 2010. I was in law school and I was using loans to pay for tuition. And Stupid. I missed it, right? Back then. And I think one of the main reasons was because I didn't understand it. Someone explained it to me that was doing a thesis on it, and he had invested quite heavily in it at that time and obviously did very well for himself. What about just the average person? Would you recommend that they invest in some type of crypto? And if so, what specific coin?
Okay. So, yes, I would say what was explained to me and right around the same time frame, 2010, 2011, when I was turned on to it. You know, just whatever you do, you're going to get an opportunity to trade it, but you need to own some and forget you own it. Put it in cold storage and with 1,000 disclaimers and warnings about not losing your password. Okay. And then I read about all these stories. I'm like, you know, these guys really weren't paranoid. People really did lose millions and tens and hundreds of millions of dollars by losing their password.
Well, this guy that I'm telling you about, he lost a handful of Bitcoin because, you know, back then there weren't these nice, easy to use wallets, digital wallets that we have now. And so he did. He lost them and they're gone forever, right?
Yeah. I had the longest, like, passwords that I wrote in my own, like, cryptic way. Like, I remembered my locker combination from high school. And in my phone, I had that locker combination. Like, I created my own crypt to, you know, besides having it in a safe in a way nobody could get it. In my phone, I had it, like, crypted up and just in case. But, you know, it was interesting. And how I got turned on to it wasn't law school. It was literally coaching baseball. Right. So I'm coaching travel baseball and this guy, Eric, moved to my town. And I don't know if you've ever read the book Flash Boys.
I haven't.
Okay. There's a company in there by the name of DRW Holdings that I believe right now is still the largest market maker in Bitcoin. And they weren't when I met him. They were dominating high frequency trading. And so Eric was like, you know, their head of IT, you know, knew a lot. And we're in the dugout and he's talking about Bitcoin. I'm like, you know, like I was like really good with stocks. Like, and I didn't realize what a ginormous world that was. I know it existed, but I didn't just realize how much money on what levels made and so many different strategies. And, you know, he introduced me. I went up to his firm, met a couple of people, like the one guy that, you know, made the proverbial first purchase of pizza at like 10,000 Bitcoin at 10 cents or something, just to prove a point in an argument that this is a peer-to-peer payment system that I should be able to pay somebody and not have the bank to put their hand in, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, all kinds of, and they're very strong libertarians, all of them. So very interesting, learned a lot. And then, you know, I'm paying attention a little bit and then I watch it go to 1,000 Bitcoin. I'm like, all right, how can we get involved in this? Talk to me. And so he goes, all right. He goes, you know, your garage. So I bought a house. The original owner had like a car collection and he had like 16 classic cars. I think he used to rent them to movie sets, but they were his babies. So he had this big compressor in the garage and it was two stories and he would have like these cars up on racks. The guy I bought the house from like took it all out, made a great room and an office upstairs and just a regular garage underneath it, right? So what's present for me is there was a compressor and this huge electrical outlet because you needed a lot of juice to be lifting cars. So Eric noticed this in my house is like has got the electrical output of like a small strip mall. He's like, we can make a lot of money. I'm like, okay. He goes, it's a fool's errand to try and go after Bitcoin. Unless you know what you're doing, unless you have the equipment at the right price, unless you have the right power and you know what you're doing with the difficulty ratios and the right hash rates, I'm telling you, you're just better off buying Bitcoin, you know, when it's cheap. Okay. But Litecoin doesn't even have an exchange here yet. And we can get an edge in that. So they took a black card of one of the traders, which was a partner of ours, and bought out all these NVIDIA chips that were like the last of the generation, right? And we put it into about 100 computers in my house, in my office down the road, and we mined Litecoin. And I was literally the Dunkin' Donuts guy. One guy, like an MIT guy, was like, he was just doing the mining and he was just making sure every week everybody got a deposit. My buddy literally rigged up the computers that was way ahead of what was out there at the time. They were throwing over a million guesses a second at an algorithm, a script algorithm that once it solves it, boom, you stamp the Litecoin. And I was the Dunkin' Donuts guy. I got my friends and family and clients and partners. I said, listen, I'll put my own money into it. You put some money into it. We'll buy some computers. This is what we're going to do. And listening to When I tell you, Alan, I put together engineers, lawyers, accountants, every walk from my retail clientele, you know, partners of Pricewaterhouse, you name it, retired partners, Ernst & Young, engineers from SanDisk, like all of them asked a lot of really skeptical, hard questions, and just the relentless logic that was just, you know, I absorbed that nobody said no. In fact, I had people call me like, what was that thing you were talking about? I'm interested. And I'm like, I can't do it anymore. I'm out of plugs. I have nowhere else to plug in a computer. And God bless my wife for letting me do this for a year. But I was the Dunkin' Donuts guy. I woke up in the middle of the night. Hey, and, you know, mine are 29, 56, and, you know, 38 are down. I would have to find out where they are on my cheat sheets and go reboot them because they ran hot. So we did this and we sat on it for 3 years. And all I watched on TV while we sit, by the way, that was our strategy. Let's get in early, hoard it.
Was it only Litecoin?
We only did Litecoin because these guys wouldn't do anything unless there was a real edge. And we knew we had an edge in it. And we talked often about pointing the mining towards different coins. And these guys are like, they prefer Bitcoin. They really only liked Litecoin and Bitcoin Cash after that. And they were like, okay on Ethereum, but not crazy about it. And a lot of the other ones, they just didn't like. So I'm like, you guys are the pros. You guys are the brilliant guys, not me. I didn't graduate MIT. I don't make $7 million a year writing a code to trade natural gas. Like, you know, like this, I'm going to take your word for it. So we did. But the interesting thing is everyone's like, we were done in 2014, 2015, right? And then you would hear like Jamie Dimon from JP Morgan and a lot of these people saying out there, you know, in the investment banking and the banking world, that's a scam or it's this or it's that, and just totally discrediting it. Meanwhile, I would send my guys in my pool, like my friends and partners, I would send them emails just without even having to give them a call, like they got the gist of it. It would be like, JP Morgan invests $1 billion into building these exchanges. They're building the derivatives, they're getting ready for this asset class to come. And it was like the one opportunity, Alan, and you lived it, you were in law school, that the actual retail guy, you know who made a lot of money with this stuff? Buddies of mine that I would meet in backyard barbecues that were electricians. This one kid made like, was up like $2 million. He was an electrician in the electricians union. And the electricians know, because a lot of these guys were the ones that were wiring this stuff and they know who was mining what. And so they're like, you should buy this. And, you know, when you're putting a decent size of money into something under a dollar or, you know, certainly well under 100, and then it goes to thousands and 10,000. You know, there's a real net worth built there.
So, Joe, what do you tell them about, you know, when to sell and what percentage to sell and stuff like this with this cryptocurrency?
Great question. It's an internal answer. I say, look, where does it serve you? Because I'm going to do what somebody that turned me onto it suggested I do. Take a chunk, put it away like you don't own it, forget you own it. And, you know, the rest is up to you. These guys said they're going to buy it and never sell it, because they believe the long term, some of these crazy, you know, forecasts as a store value of being a half a million or a million a coin on Bitcoin. Maybe that happens. I don't know. But for me, I'm sitting there and it was stealth. And so this is how I explain it to them. I give them my story and how it served me. And hopefully when you get in my mind how I thought it just happened to work out for me, it could have easily gone the other way and I would have been okay with it. Because I've traded for years and you're never going to be perfect on trades, ever, 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 ever. And so you just got to have that mindset that you know, right? And when I got emotional and I thought I was too smart, that's where I made too many mistakes. So I wasn't going to do it now. But I've got five kids. My oldest two just graduated in 2020. You know, Dean's List, Villanova University. My son's working for KPMG, CPA already. My daughter went to my alma mater, Marist College. And so for me personally, to answer that question, I'm sitting there and it's like stealth. I'm like, man, this thing blew through 250. This thing is blowing through 300. And now we break 350 and it had been on my mind and I'm sitting there going, wait, let me do the math. I'm talking about $600,000 in educational cost over 6 years for private high school and college, just for my twins. And I have three more coming up. Like if being a Dunkin' Donuts guy and waking up every morning, I'm sorry, the middle of the night quite often. I actually trained my kids how to reboot computers if I had to take my wife out to dinner, you know. But all of that work is going to really pay off. If I just say that doing that for a year, if I show my wife seeing these ugly computers all over the garage in the house for a year, if that meant our kids' education was paid for, isn't that worth it? We're not going to Vegas. I'm not buying some car. I'm like, Yeah. And so when it broke out, I'm like, I literally had it ready in my mind. I'm set. I'm like, I'm going to sell this. I'm looking for a sign to sell it, and I know it's going to serve me. I'm going to hold on to some just in case it keeps going, right? But what did it for me, and it's a different story for a different day about CNBC and Jim Cramer, that I had a big position once, that I was a contrarian to Jim Cramer, and thank God. Now, Jim Cramer didn't say anything, but CNBC did. They came on. It was the very end of 2017, December, close to Christmas. I remember meeting my old trader buddy out for like a holiday, you know, happy hour, touch base with him. And I told him about this trade and it was unbelievable. We're at the bar and I'm hearing my pitch to my friends 3 years ago, 4 years ago, now at the bar. I'm like, he goes, that sounded like you 3-4 years ago. Yeah. But what did it for me, Alan, was CNBC said, Litecoin's going to 500 and they got a chart at 375. I go, that's it. That's it. That was in my nervous system since I was a retail broker on Wall Street. That was the third research report. I trained my way of thinking, and my clients all agreed, thinking the same way. By the time the third research report, the third buy report hits your desk, it's too late. Smart money's already been made. And I lived that for 20 years on Wall Street, and I'm living it now in private. And when I see CNBC hyping it up, I'm out. It serves me. So if it serves you, sell it. I don't know. I'm not worried about the sell side unless it really serves my goals. And I hope that answered your question.
No, it does. And it's interesting because of how volatile cryptocurrency is. I'm going to read you a quick quote from Michael Saylor. He said, none of the trading matters. None of the volatility matters. People that are living in their little world, studying their Fibonacci retracements and preaching with incredible conviction about the upcoming expected 60% retracement or 80% retracement, they're overlooking this fundamental issue, which is if Bitcoin is a digital monetary network and if enough people with money and power decide to adopt it, it's going to go up and increase by a factor of 100 or 1,000, and there's nothing you can do to stop it.
Boom. I consider that gospel, and I agree with that. But there's two distinctions. One, like in support of that theory, and one that presents other opportunities, right? One is, I just look at, what is gold? And by the way, these are conversations that I'm having now that I had in 2013 with my investors, my partners. Okay. They were. And like all of the predictions on the blockchain, all this other stuff came true. They talked about, you know, people can't really wrap their head around it like you and I at that time. Right. But it's not really a currency, but if you kind of give it an analogy to gold, and for us, Litecoin was the silver to Bitcoin's gold. So that was kind of our analogy. But in truth and in reality, it's really not a currency. But if you compare it to a gold, they'll get that. Because after all, what is gold? It's a rock, right? There's a finite amount of it. It's hard to get. And there's utility for it. Some people use it in electronics these days in different companies. And a lot of people use it for jewelry. But it's considered a very stable store of value.
But Joe, I could see people saying something like, with gold, I can feel it and I can touch it, right? Like I can put it in a safe in, you know, in my house, and I can, you know, take it out and look at it and dust it. But with cryptocurrency, it's like, it's literally an algorithm, right?
Well, it's still a rock. Gold is still a rock, right? So think about that. Okay, so you hold it. You got a rock. You got a piece of earth in your safe. Like you can, but also like, how about if I want to buy a penthouse in Manhattan and I'm a Saudi Arabian prince? I'm going to buy that because it's on sale for $50 million, right? Are you going to bring a bunch of gold to the closing? Or how about you just sent an email? And in the email is, you know, validated, verified, 8, you know, validations on the blockchain, no fraud. And by the way, the title's in there too. No fraud, no, you know, like very efficient, very way of transferring a store of value, right? So like that utility blows away all of the shortcomings of gold as a currency. But I agree with you. It reminds me of when I was 28 and I'm asking the young kids, talk to me about what a browser is. And I want to learn more about the internet because this is a thing. It's got to be more than just a convenient way to send mail or now Amazon selling books. Like these valuations, there's something more to it and I need to know, right? So I had that same philosophy here. And I just know, I use my father as an example, God rest his soul. I had a lot of clients the same way, Alan. I would never put my credit card out with our internet thing in public. Never. Never, 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 never. Meanwhile, you know, 2 years later, he's like, you know, Santa Claus, you know, buying for his grandkids online, loving the computer, yeah. You know. So there's going to be resistance based on a knowingness that someone has, but knowledge and adoption is going to deteriorate that concept, if you will, of, oh, I don't know what it is. Well, it's digital. It's a store of value that is perceived, and billionaires are buying it. Companies are buying it and they're looking at it as part of their, you know, treasury. They're looking at it as, holy shit, excuse my vernacular, but America's going broke. The dollar is weak. The central bank looks upside down. I need a really good store of value. So now you have people like Goldman Sachs that have gone 180 degrees and they're saying Bitcoin can absolutely coexist with gold as a digital gold and not be an existential threat. They can peacefully coexist. Really? You've changed your tune pretty much. And they have some crazy price targets of, you know, even 535,000 at some point. If you look at it, and then another company, Morgan Creek, I believe it was, advisors, one of them came out and said, as it relates to gold, Bitcoin is 10 times more efficient as a store of value. 10 times more efficient. Okay. Well, if you give it 1/10 of the valuation, that's $1 trillion because gold is worth $10 trillion. Then at $1 trillion, you are at 50,000 on Bitcoin. So that's why I think it's got legs in 2021. I wouldn't be surprised if it breaks 100,000. I think, you know, the concern of the global and our economy, you know, is going to fuel that flame. But yeah, I just think people in due time that would never, you know, basically, you know, put their credit card, put their information out on the internet, you know, are like e-commerce, you know, building businesses in e-commerce, not alone, you know, like just buying things there. So,
you know, is there any weight to this concept that, hey, what about the IRS, man? How are these guys going to, if we're buying and selling, right, with this secure currency, how do they get their cut?
So there's no question that's been a concern or a thought all along, but the libertarians will tell you that you're just being a spoiled American because you have a dollar, which now is getting weak, but there are so many people around the world, you don't even need a lot of money, but people that literally are scared, you know what, that their currency when they wake up in the morning, like in Venezuela, doesn't move 4 decimal points and all of a sudden your life savings are gone. So there are people that have, and I'm involved in a company that, you know, trades publicly, got them in mining Bitcoin early. And, you know, they have one division, one subsidiary of the company has like, you know, 30,000 distributors around the world. And one of the things that really attracts them, first of all, it's a pandemic, so you could do it as a home-based business. So that globally, it has grown. But the insatiable desire, when they find out you can get compensated for work in Bitcoin, is tremendous. And that's not to be denied. So I don't think the IRS can stop a technology. They can get in the way, but they've kind of made pledges not to. And I think there will be ways on these exchanges, on these wallets, to find out, you know, who's been doing what. Is there a lot that people are getting away with? Probably, but I really believe they'll figure it out as they go, that there'll be less and less and less of it, because it will be an asset class. Like, this was unheard of when I started this in 2013, but now you have retirement accounts that are saying you can invest in Bitcoin in your IRA or your self-directed IRA. Yes, we will take that. Yes, like that didn't exist. So, you know, there's an old expression, Alan, you know, don't fight the tape or the market climbs a wall of worry. I think the IRS will figure it out. I think that the wallets that don't want to deal with the IRS will figure out a way to make sure there's reporting for the vast majority of Americans that are, you know, trading it or investing in it. And exactly how that will be, I don't know. I'm not an expert there. But I just think that the global supply and demand you know, will dictate higher prices, you know, and the IRS can get in the way. Maybe short term, they're doing something here or there that causes a disruption. But, you know, here's another thing. So Bitcoin as a great store of value, I don't think is going away. But there are other utilities. So like, and there's one that I'm getting involved with that's adaptive, meaning don't expect it to go from 100 to 10,000. Expect it to really outperform anything you're doing without volatility. And that's a currency, a digital currency that could be adopted by several different foreign governments or even some major corporations. And it was developed with the flaws of Bitcoin in mind. Not that it has a flaws.
Are you at liberty to say what the name of that currency is?
Yes, it's called Endow. So basically, it literally has some components in it. And I'll just do the elevator ride layman's explanation, where in order to support it, it's not in your interest. If there's too much selling, that coin would actually dissolve and burn off and go away. So if you're a holder in it, it's in your interest to hold it. If you sell too much, there's more commission charge to you, which goes back into the coin, which stabilizes the coin. So there's a stabilization mechanism, which basically its intent is to be used as a digital currency, and you're rewarded for holding it long term. And so it's like this. So the CEO of the publicly traded company that I'm a big investor in for 8 years now, literally at one point was the second largest Bitcoin miner in the world. He's a fintech pioneer. He's had several different projects that he has started that he sold out and sold to the likes of TD Ameritrade, Bank of New York. Recently, he sold a company called T0 to Overstock.com. And I didn't own any, but I watched Overstock.com go from like 7 to 120. So the proximity to fintech pioneers like this is what has me excited, because, you know, they may not have gotten out at the high of Bitcoin or some other projects, but they're already early, really early in the next thing. And so it was explained to me at a meeting like this. Okay, do you remember MySpace? Well, it came out and it was very popular, and all of its flaws were exploited and fixed with something called Facebook. The same way, I don't know if you're as old as I am, 53, but do you remember, Alan, the name Lycos?
Sounds familiar. I'm a few years behind you, but
all right.
I'll catch up one of these days.
It's a search engine. Lycos, I remember the stock, LCOS, right? Okay. Never really traded it, yeah. But I remember it. Anyway, as a search engine, cutting edge, that's cool. And they came out on the scene dominant with Yahoo search. And there was a meeting of fintech pioneers, like my friend Joe. And, you know, he was there. And apparently at that meeting where Lycos, the keynote speakers, and Yahoo search, some kid gets up and says, what if I told you that your search engines are going to be obsolete in the near term, that there's another search engine that's going to blow you all away and you don't even know who it is? And everyone's like, you know, who's this kid and who let him in the room? And that was Sergey Brin from Google. And so,
oh my goodness,
there's constantly brilliant people always innovating, and Bitcoin is brilliant. If you ask me, it's going to remain the dominant store of value. But all of the other shortcomings, and the biggest shortcoming is volatility. There's a lot of utility that they can't use because of the volatility. You want to be a trader and investor with this stuff, play the volatility, do what you got to do. But if you're going to use it to transact commerce and use it as a currency or all these other applications, you are not served by the volatility of Bitcoin. So this Endow was designed as the world's first adaptive technology to fix that one major flaw, and it's a big market for it.
So I'm going to run a scenario by you here, Joe. Let's say I give you 100 or 1,000 or 100,000, a million, whatever quantity you feel like is appropriate for this hypothetical, and I tell you to buy cryptocurrency. What do you buy? What's the breakdown? Is it split up? Is it you just buy one type? What do you do with that money?
Do you own any Bitcoin now?
I do.
Okay. So, you know, you've got to make this decision because I'm not an advisor. I played that on TV for 20 years. I'm like playing in the world of, I'll educate you and I'll show you where to go do it, and we'll build value in our ecosystem, and maybe we do projects together, but I'll just try and have you ask the questions you should ask yourself. Like, okay, how much Bitcoin do you have? Is it enough? Of this 100 grand, is 100 grand a lot more in the Bitcoin holding that you already have? Or is it like, you have enough Bitcoin, I want something else? So once you ask that question, if you have enough Bitcoin, I would have no problem. I stay narrow. when I was really, really good at trading stocks for 20 years, I literally stayed narrow with a little bit of diversity. Like, you asked me what industries I specialized in. Like, my first wife got breast cancer. I specialized in biotech and like cancer and oncology. And my biggest winner in my career, one of them was right up there, was ImClone. You know, Martha Stewart and Sam Waxel, the CEO, went to jail. And by the time they went to jail, that stock was already trading much higher. So I'll do the homework and I'll hold a few different positions. For me, it was Bitcoin, Litecoin, and I was told Bitcoin Cash because of the fork and all this other stuff. I've never bought really anything but Bitcoin and Litecoin. And I know there are others, but for me, I saw too many. I want to stay with a couple of the top dogs and be comfortable that I own enough of it and it's the right ones, because I remember the dot-coms. And for every Amazon, there was 50 pets.com, right? So there's so many cryptocurrencies that don't necessarily have this huge edge. They might have a market cap. You might be able to trade them, but I'm not interested in trading them. I'm interested in investing in them. So for that said, I would maybe buy a little bit of this Bitcoin. I have also, for true diversification, I have a company that literally is a preferred share offering that's almost like a proxy for Bitcoin that'll give you a little bit of diversity for Bitcoin, and it'll give you some additional upside without additional risk, in that it's a preferred share offering, so you're not expecting volatility on a preferred share if you know the difference between a preferred and a common share, but it pays you 13%. So a lot of guys in their self-directed IRA, including myself, will be literally, okay, I'm getting 6% in Vanguard or Fidelity. Great job. I'm not going to get out of all of it, but I'm going to take a chunk of that. Like I think we talked about earlier, Forbes says an individual portfolio should have at least a 30% allocation towards alternative investments, right? And I want a whole alternative investment that's asset-backed, that's giving you a nice rate of return.
Well, what does that mean, alternative investment?
Just non-traditional. Like something
just not that, stocks and bonds.
Stocks and bonds is 60-40. So I'll hold that thought and I'll address that, right? So I was watching, I think I put it up on LinkedIn, one of my partners that I work with, probably my daughter, on LinkedIn. But I was talking, I was watching literally a couple of weeks ago, Alan, and I'm listening to a talking head on TV. And they're saying, because of the pandemic, the rates went down 100 basis points. So all of these retirement accounts literally have to do something to make up for that 100 point miss in interest rates. And so your account's got to work harder just to adjust for what we went down in rates for the pandemic. And I'm like, okay. And I couldn't believe my ears. And I'm a risk guy. I like to mitigate my risk. I like to do my homework. And I'm a stock guy for years. I mean, not as much anymore for sure, as far as, you know, the veracity and the volume and the trading. No, nothing like I used to be, but I still love stocks. And this guy turns around on TV and says, the adjustment to your traditional 60-40 portfolio is 80-20. And he's talking about, like, for your average 50-year-old that's going to retire in 15 years to make up for your time. And I'm like,
that seems pretty aggressive.
I looked at the TV. I go, did this guy just say 80-20, 80% stocks? So for me, you go ahead. It's your business. But for me, I would say, okay, why don't you just diversify away from stocks and bonds, have a little bit more alternative, which is non-correlated to the stock market, which is not going to experience the same up and down. And if you could do that and have true diversification and increase your income, your rate, that's a win. There is a retirement gap in our country, Alan, that basically the average American retiree is retiring with 19 months of income saved and 23 years of life expectancy. And that's not a guess. That's not my numbers. That's the ACLI, the American Council of Life Insurance, put that number out last year. So if we could just help close the gap a little bit by being a special teams coach over here and saying, hey, you should have a financial planner. They should be a fiduciary. They got to be good. I know a lot of them. I trust one. I only refer one, but that's just me. And you need that. But that person knows also that while they can't invest in a lot of alternatives, there is a space for them. They just can't, because of their license, recommend them. So they could be there and they could put it on a portfolio and on a platform and say, okay, that's what you like over there and alternatives. Okay. And, you know, that's kind of the way it should be, a hybrid where you have a financial planner and you're doing things on your own that you appreciate and that you know and you've done the homework in. And so, you know, that's basically, you know, where we are as far as that portfolio. But if I say, okay, you take 30% of that portfolio and you put it in, you know, you want to diversify that a little bit in having income. And if you're making 13% versus 6% and average, you know, you're ahead of the game. As far as the preferred offering I'm talking about, you get additional warrants in the company. So if Bitcoin explodes, okay, this stock can explode with it, but you don't have to take that additional risk because you have warrants that are good for 5 years. So you can own some cheap stock and exercise it if and when you want, depending on the price of the stock. But in the meantime, you got some preferred shares, right, that are giving you 13%. You get mailbox money every quarter. You get 3.25%. That 3.25% is as much as you'll earn in 3 years in a bank, you're earning every 3 months. So I think we're ahead of the game there. We're increasing our return, and we got a marker as a proxy for Bitcoin if Bitcoin takes off. So I would buy that, and I would also buy some of this Endow, which is the world's first, you know, adaptive currency that once it goes mainstream and once it gets more popular and once there's more of an understanding, I would also own some of that one, and I can explain that one, you know, offline. But here's another one. You ready?
I'm ready.
Okay, here's one that I don't know why you can't. And in full disclosure, I own all of what I say I own. I'm going to go back to my investing strategy when I got on Wall Street. My grandmother taught me at a young age, watch what people do with their hands, not their mouth. I own everything that I say. Hey, by the way, I'm buying this. You may want to think about it. If it's not for you, it's not for you. That's fine. I can point you where to go do it. But nobody's got a gun to your head. You've got to think about it. And I encourage you, talk to your advisor, do your own homework, or all of the above. That's number 1, 2, 3 through 10 right there. That being said, there's something else that I bought. And again, it's proximity, right? And I got in through the Princeton Alumni Fund, but it was my buddy who said, listen, if you want, you know, you got to come up with $1 million, probably roughly would be kind of a minimum, but you can get into this deal. Now, I don't know if you remember, Alan, these ICOs, these initial coin offerings that happened a few years ago, two, three years ago. Tron, there were so many coins that were going to like literally like multi-billion dollar valuations. And my buddy, who turned me on to crypto very early, said, hey, look at these things. You know, and he giggled, he laughed. He like, we looked into these. Like, there's effing nothing there. And he goes, I'm telling you, people are going to go to jail and these things are going to collapse. Sure enough, over the next 2 or 3 years, a lot of these ICOs, it's like a coin instead of an IPO for shares, they're coming up with their own corporate coin, right? And raising money. And they're just, in doing so, a lot of them were breaking, like, you know, securities and banking laws because they weren't a registered broker dealer or bank or any of the above, right? My buddy says, look, this one here, okay, it's called Blockstacks. He said, I'll send you the white paper. If you want, you get in on it. So I called a whole bunch of my people. We gave a bunch with all the guys that made money in Litecoin, like, I'm in. I got to get liquid. I'm in. I want to come up with, you know, 50, 100, whatever the number is, they're in. And for me, all that needed to do for me was, first of all, I read the white paper. Second of all, I understood some of it, right? To be honest, I understood most of it with a gist. Some of it I got. And I wouldn't have got as much of it if I didn't have that exposure early on to crypto. But they were working hand in hand with the SEC to be the first SEC-approved ICO, and I appreciated that. And all of the guys building it were from Princeton. So through the Princeton Alumni Fund, I can get in if I do one. If I got 50 people that want to get in on it, they're going to send me the money. I'm going to handle the separate paperwork with them. I'm going to have them open up their own wallets so that when I get it, I'll just disperse it and give everybody their coin, goes to their wallet. I paper everything up. We're good. But it's a way for a lot of us to get involved in something that takes $1 million minimum, right? And we they're not going to accept 50 people's paperwork. But as a friend with proximity, they were able to let my company go in and buy over $1 million worth. Great. All I knew, Alan, talk about insider buying, talk about proximity. The Winklevoss twins and all of the titans of crypto were in this thing at 9 cents on the seed round. I said, I'm in. I get it. And plus, my buddy wouldn't show me something unless he's done a ton of homework more than I could. He's already done it. And he's got that much credibility. So I'm like, all right, I'm in. We're doing it. And bottom line is that about 6 months later, the Harvard Endowment Association put about $50 million into it. I believe it was 30 cents a coin. And right now, like, it hit 56 cents a coin the other day. It's right now probably about 44 cents a coin before I got on the phone here. I watch it. It's up 4 or 5 times from where we bought it in the last couple of years. But I believe once they have a client or two that's going to be significant, this thing could be $10 from 50 cents a coin. Now, on January 14th, they allowed trading in the U.S., but Coinbase or Binance, you'll see it trading. They don't have it up on their domestic, you know, account yet. And I don't know why. I already own it because I'm in the seed round. So full disclosure, I'm in the seed round. I'm not selling it. It's up 4 to 5 fold, but I just think there's so much more upside, because here's something where the blockchain and everything I heard about it years ago starts coming in full effect, Alan. Have you obviously been paying attention not only to the Reddit stuff, but this whole censoring stuff from POTUS, whether you hate him or love him, all of his followers? Now other companies have literally their entire business plan and years of work. You know, it's like, okay, I got to shut down. Everyone's got to lose money. It's totally un-American. Put the bias aside, right? Bottom line is you have a company like Stax, STX. Go to Binance, STX is the symbol. And they basically say, hey, and I listened to this call 2 years ago, right? And this is the kind of perception that I watched come true in a few years, just having proximity to really bright people way smarter than me. And they talked about the old internet business model, which is what we have today. They're calling it the old internet business model, which is Google, Amazon, Facebook, all of them, Twitter, where they're going to give you a service as a consumer, and they're going to take your data for that service. They're going to go make money with your data, and then they're going to manipulate the shit out of you with your own data and make even more money. But as I remember on a conference call a couple of years ago, they talked about the human brain not being able to handle the amount of biased information. So your own bias gets reinforced to a boiling point, to the point where they talked about it causing a civil war in our country, literally predicted it. And now you kind of see it happening.
It's crazy. So
the solution with Stax is, hey, come build your company on Stax, on the blockchain, on a Bitcoin, and you own all of your own data. You're not beholden to Amazon, Google, Twitter, Facebook, nobody. So you DeFi. Watch out for this word, DeFi. You decentralize everything, and it's like giving freedom back to the markets and building on the blockchain. And that would be my three things that I would buy. I hope I answered your question.
Gotcha. Yeah, it did 100%. So, and I wish I had another 3 hours for this. And what I would love to do, because of how fast things changes, I'd love to do, you know, a version two of this conversation in about 6 months, kind of a recap of what has happened over 6 months or 8 months or whatever it is, and touch base and see how the cryptocurrency market has changed. Before I let you go, Joe, I have to ask you this. Are you familiar with Dogecoin?
I think they call it Dogecoin.
Yeah, I didn't know if it was dog or doge, because it is D-O-G-E, I believe.
Yeah. Dog.
But it was started as a complete joke, right? Even on their website, it has this you know, this dog has a famous meme or whatever.
Doggy coin.
And he's riding a rocket to the moon.
Yes.
But it's up 190% in the last like 24 hours.
Maybe you are pronouncing it correctly, and I, in my own head, looking at it, but that coin is not new. It's been around, and it's not something that I know. If it was something worth buying, I would have heard it, at least from the world that I have access to. I don't go outside the world. That doesn't mean that there isn't a bunch of winners and losers that exist outside that world. I just try to like buy it right, like eliminate mistakes. So for me, I can do some homework on it for the next time. I don't know enough about it, so I don't like to opine. But I would say that like the one that I will tell you they called Ripple, like they were like, it's shit, it's bullshit, don't trust it, don't like it. And they didn't go out and short it or bash it. It was just an internal conversation of would you buy it or not. And they were like, no. Like, first of all, maybe it gets some clientele, but every big customer that would be worth having could just emulate what they're doing and do the same thing. And so they had all these rapid reasons why, no. And now when it went down, I had a lot of people asking. So I said, you know what? Let me run it up the flagpole. Is it worth buying now? And I didn't like buying stocks that got beat up, that had pending lawsuits, and you got to depend on a jury or a judge or some, you know, it was too much gambling for me instead of smart investing. And as far as Ripple, it was like, listen, nobody wants to touch that thing with a 10-foot pole. None of the exchanges are going to trade it. And, you know, they're at odds with the regulators. Like, why would you even buy it? Doesn't make sense. Not worth the risk. So they were right about that. They didn't say anything bad about Dogecoin. They've never said anything good about Dogecoin or Dogecoin. It could be great. I don't know enough about it, but I'll do my best to find out, and we'll see where it is in 6 months.
Awesome. I just think it's crazy that they can create it as a joke. And I hear that it has an infrastructure similar to Litecoin, but one of the main differences is there's no volume cap on it. But it's crazy that it was literally created as a joke. And I have a buddy that's done 190% over the last 24 hours. And so,
wow,
it just kind of goes to show you, especially in light of, and we didn't get into this at all, but the GameStop scenario that just happened within the last few days. And you talked about how the internet changed trading because of real-time information. And it's done much more than that nowadays, right? You can get a group together on the internet that can affect a stock price and can, you know, put people on Wall Street in jeopardy of losing their jobs, right?
Yeah, 100%. You know, they don't like a perceived injustice. They don't like the way things have gone and constantly get away with it. Maybe it was a common thread that GameStop was, you know, a victim, you know, to a corrupt system. I mean, perception's reality, whether it's true or not, perception's reality. And, you know, that's what happens. And that's why we say, listen to the kids. Like, they'll, you know, a lot of them are home in the pandemic, and with a little bit of money, a lot of them are trading, they're investing, and they're changing the rules of the game. You know, the GameStop thing is very interesting. I don't short stocks. I shorted one of my whole career, and that's a different story for a different day. But yeah, it's just very interesting. The power of the individuals, the Zoom calls, the freedom of information in real time and trading. I mean, I think it's horrible that Robinhood, I'm not taking any side of this argument. I have no dog in the fight. But for Robinhood to not allow trading in it, I just think it's anti-American, un-American. Like, why? You know, because the elites and the media and Wall Street don't want to see these funds. Maybe they have money in there. Maybe some important friends of the elites have money in these funds. And, you know, cut off the spigot if you allow them to buy any more GameStop. That just seems very counterproductive. You have the right to say anything you want, in my humble opinion. You know, people die in wars for your right to be ignorant. Okay, well, they have the same thing with speaking applies to investing. So in my humble opinion. So I know that thing was down today. I kind of keep a casual eye on it. And it's more of a kind of a history lesson for me, you know, kind of like a little bit of theater, right?
Yeah. I love it, Joe. Your wealth of knowledge is obvious. This is the episode that I definitely was involved the least in. And that's exactly how I wanted it. So we're going to have to revisit some of these topics. And just to kind of get you thinking, I would love to talk about Tesla. 2020 was crazy for Tesla. So I'd like to talk about Tesla next time. I'd like to do a revisit of GameStop, see what ended up happening with them, and then kind of some of these cryptocurrencies that we've talked about. But we'll have to push that off to another day, maybe 6-8 months down the road, and catch up with you. I know you're very busy and obviously very successful at what you do. And so, Joe, did you want us to put any of your information out there in case somebody wanted to reach out to you?
Sure, absolutely. You know, connect with me on LinkedIn. It's Joseph Hagen. Shoot me an email, joe@wealthcolony.com, or book an appointment. I think that's www.calendly.com/wealthcolony. And if I send you back an email, it'll have all my contact information on it.
That's perfect. All right, Joe. Hey, thanks for joining us today. You know, we appreciate your time and best of luck with everything.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. Look forward to, you know, helping anybody answer any questions and interact with anybody on anything that may be on your mind. And Alan, it's been real. Thank you so much.
If you've enjoyed today's podcast, please leave us a rating. And for daily inspiration and business tips, follow Alan on Instagram. Until next time, remember, we build the future one entrepreneur at a time.